Iran-backed militias in Iraq intensify aerial attacks on U.S. forces in the region in response to U.S. ally Israel's war to destroy Hamas, an Iranian proxy group in Gaza. A Washington-based researcher explains what the attacks indicate about Iran's intentions toward the U.S.
The Iranians are raising pressure and tension within the region, but in a way that's unlikely to draw a very heavy U.S. response.
Plus, a VOA Persian reporter describes the messages she receives from people in Iran concerned about the war that Hamas triggered with its terror attack against Israel.
They said, "We are not satisfied if our country's money is spent on terrorist activities."
And how will the expiration of UN sanctions on Iran's missile program affect the proliferation of Iranian weapons? From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. The Pentagon says Iranian proxy forces have attacked U.S. and coalition troops in Iraq and Syria at least 13 times in the past week. Speaking Tuesday, Pentagon Press Secretary Patrick Ryder said the attacks involved a mix of one-way drones and rockets. No casualties were reported among U.S. forces. Iran-backed militias in Iraq have claimed responsibility for the strikes, calling them a response to U.S. military and political support for Israel. The Jewish state is seeking to destroy Hamas following the group's October 7th terror assault on southern Israel. Ryder said the U.S. is preparing for what he called the prospect of a more significant escalation against U.S. forces and personnel across the region in the very near term from Iranian proxy forces and ultimately from Iran. Michael Knights is a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, specializing in Mideast security. I asked him on the phone Tuesday how much coordination there is between Tehran and those proxy forces in Iraq.
The reality is that Iran always has what they call a jihadi assistant who sits in the room with the military committee of the Iraqi Shia militias and listens as they discuss their attack plans for strikes on U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria. And that means that the Iranians are there to do two things. They're there to provide any technical support that might be needed, for instance, in how to use the drones that they've given to the Iraqi Shia militias, or in how to defeat U.S. missile or drone defenses. But they're also there to make sure that the Iraqi Shia militias don't kill too many Americans. Now, it may sound a bit odd, but what the Iranians have done in recent years is to kind of perfect a way of prodding the Americans and demonstrating resistance to their regional presence in the Middle East without actually drawing heavy retaliation from American forces.
So how can Iran pull off such a feat, which seems difficult to do?
So prodding the Americans with attacks without drawing heavy American military retaliation is something that the Iran-backed militias in Iraq are actually really expert at. How do they do it? The main way they do it is to use drone systems that they've been provided by the Iranians, called the Kasif-2K, and which the Iranians also provided to Yemen's Houthis. Because these drones are very accurate, it allows the Iran-backed militias, with some Iranian targeting advice, to aim their exact points of impact slightly away from where, for instance, U.S. personnel are sleeping or working. And the Iranians also know that many of the drones will be intercepted on the way in. So in some ways, it's a bit of a deadly game whereby the Iranians, as part of this broader effort to put America on notice, not to support Israel, not to support an Israeli ground operation in Gaza, the Iranians are raising pressure and tension within the region, but in a way that's unlikely to draw a very heavy U.S. response because it causes a large number of American casualties.
Do you think the United States would accept those Iran-backed militias restraining somewhat their attacks so that there wouldn't be a big retaliation?
Yes, the U.S. understands very well this situation. And that's why it's broadly comfortable with what the Iran-backed militias in Iraq and Syria do in terms of mounting almost always non-lethal attacks on the US that the US finds quite easy to defend against. It's almost a kind of deadly game played between the two sides since about 2019. Now, this is convenient for both the US and Iran because the US does not want to get drawn into another Middle Eastern war. But Iran and the Iran-backed militias cannot simply give up on resisting American military presence in Iraq. And at a moment like this Gaza conflict, they have to show some kind of support for Hamas.
I wanted to ask about all of the forces that the United States has sent to the region since the start of the war. They include aircraft carrier strike groups in the Mediterranean. And the message from the Biden administration has been that these forces are there to deter other actors from widening the conflict, trying to prevent a more regional war from erupting. But in light of what we've just discussed, what is really the aim of the U.S. deterrent strategy? Is it to have just small-scale attacks on U.S. forces that are not lethal, or is it to deter any kinds of attacks?
The U.S. definitely has a threshold below which it does not respond. And the kinds of attacks we're seeing in Iraq and Syria are reasonably easy for the U.S. to ignore. There have been over 90 of these attacks since the Biden administration took office, and the U.S. has only hit back four times. So this is something where there's something of a response ratio because the attacks are not very lethal. The U.S. holds back from responding each time. Now, the U.S. military presence in the Eastern Mediterranean, including two aircraft carrier battle groups, is not really focused on these small attacks by Iraqi militias. It's focused on defending Israel from the big attack that might come from Lebanese Hezbollah and could potentially involve Yemen Houthis as well.
Now, I think the obvious question for me here is, do you think that the U.S. will be successful when it comes to Hezbollah, which has the capability, unlike some of those other Iran-backed militias in Iraq and Syria, to actually carry out massive assaults on Israel with missiles and other weapons?
So the first thing to say is that the U.S. presence has already been effective in blunting one particular attack on Israel, which was the Houthi long-range cruise missile and drone attack that was intercepted in the Red Sea by the U.S. cruiser, USS Cagney. So this demonstrates that one part of the U.S. military presence is holding a flank for Israel, protecting one of its vulnerable sides, and this removes that onus from the Israelis to defend that southern flank. In terms of Lebanese Hezbollah, the presence of two U.S. carrier battle groups in the region is probably sufficient to deter both Lebanese Hezbollah and Iran itself from becoming much more involved in the war in Israel.
And why do you think that is?
If Iran now understands that the U.S. is so heavily committed to this crisis, that if Iran and Lebanese Hezbollah want to attack critical infrastructure in Israel in a crippling way, then they will face the full might of the U.S. military. And this means that they have a very clear choice. Iran can lose Lebanese Hezbollah as an ally that it's built up over 40 years, or it can restrain Lebanese Hezbollah from mounting a full-scale attack on Israel. Now, the Biden administration's primary interest in the Middle East is de-escalation. They do not want to be involved in Middle Eastern wars. They want to be doing Ukraine. They want to be doing deterrence in the South China Sea with Taiwan. And so what they really want to do is to prevent this war from spreading. And that means projecting very high levels of force right now so that neither Lebanese Hezbollah nor Iran miscalculate and enter this war thinking that the U.S. will not respond.
Michael Knights, head of the Militia Spotlight platform at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, joining us on the line from here in Washington, D.C. Thank you very much for coming on to Flashpoint Iran.
My pleasure.
Iran's Islamist rulers praised the Hamas terror attack on Israel, whose destruction they have long called for. But there are signs that many people in Iran disagree. In one social media video posted after the war started, Iranian soccer fans chanted against Palestinian flags displayed at a stadium. In another, Iranians booed a filmmaker who made anti-Israel comments at a gathering in Tehran. My colleague Rosita Irandust has received messages from audience members in Iran about the war and shared them on a series of special VOA Persian TV programs. She told me more about them when we sat down in our studio.
So my roles, I'm a co-host in that show. And my main task is just review comments, get the comments from Iran, especially from Iran, and voicemail. And now I build this bridge, people to Iran, and they trust me and send me lots of voicemail. And they are so comfortable. This is my task. But I have another one in news shows every day. Just monitor social media and find the related comments and post in X, Instagram, and other platforms to just review on the show.
Well, Rosita, tell us what kind of voicemails have you been getting from people about this war between Israel and Hamas?
Michael, as general, I can tell you we had last 2 weeks, we have two programs on Hamas and Israel war. And we are going to have actually this week too, the third week. But almost all the followers condemn the Hamas attack. And many consider the killing of civilians on both sides to be an inhuman act.
When we look at the voicemails that are coming in to you, is there any way of telling whether these audience members are calling you from inside Iran or from outside Iran? Because, of course, VOA Persian does have a big audience in the Iranian diaspora around the world.
You're right. But special show or focus to get the voicemail from Iran.
That's the most interesting, I think, isn't it?
That's why I'm so proud because I was able to do that. And right now, I can tell you more than 70% of voicemail coming from Iran, because how do I know?
Yes, how do you know?
Yeah, exactly. Because they couldn't access the internet all the time. So they usually tell me, Rosita, can I send you later? Because I don't have a proxy. I'm going to get it.
You have to find all kinds of ways to get around the blocking of the internet there.
Especially, for example, I can recognize during our specific show on internet. So they told me about the quality of the internet from Zahedan, from Tehran, from Mashhad, all over Iran. So I know exactly they are from Iran.
What are the most interesting voicemails that you've received so far regarding the war?
Michael, the voicemail and the comments, I can tell you, I just collect some of them. For example, almost 80% of them focus on the money that the U.S. gave to the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Are you talking about the $6 billion of Iranian funds that were unfrozen as part of the deal between Iran and the U.S. to exchange prisoners?
And they said, we are not satisfied if our country's money is spent on terrorist activities. This is the most common comments in social media platforms. Or, for example, I collect some of them for you. Cheyenne, one of our followers, say, destroying Hamas will not repair Israel's damaged reputation. Without the destructions of Khamenei regime, it is impossible to ensure Israel's security. You know, they feel the pain that people in Israel, they suffered during this attack.
And why do you think that is?
Because they know exactly Islamic Republic is behind this attack. And they believe the Islamic Republic just managed this war. if you can go through the especially X platform, you can see a lot of comments same as this one.
Do you see comments or voice messages that are perhaps expressing more sympathy for Palestinians, for example, or any criticism of Israel? Or is it really predominantly the other way, more sympathy for Israel and support for what Israel is doing?
The Iranian who against Islamic Republic of Iran, the almost 98%, 95% just against the Hamas, and they support Israel. Why? Because I can definitely tell you, the Iranian people, the first people in the world that create hashtag for Israel. You know that one. And Iranians stand with Israel.
That is a hashtag that people are using in Farsi, a hashtag in Farsi.
They created in Farsi and English. They created both of them, and they expressed their opinion to social media platforms. But you ask me about who supports Palestine, pro-government.
So you are seeing some messages like that?
Yes. Yes. We got it. Yeah. People, they are not happy if children are killed in Gaza because they are children, but they are against Hamas.
That's an important distinction to make.
Yes, as a human.
Well, Rozita Irandust, reporter for VOA Persian, nice to speak with you again in our studio. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. UN Security Council sanctions imposing limits on Iran's trade in advanced missiles and attack drones expired on October 18th. The Security Council had imposed those limits for an 8-year period as part of a resolution endorsing the 2015 nuclear deal between Iran and world powers. That deal unraveled after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew in 2018, and Iran began exceeding limits on nuclear activities a year later. The U.S. and its European allies say they will keep their own sanctions on Iran's missile and drone programs in place. But will that be enough to prevent Iran from boosting its weapons exports? I put that question to researcher Fabian Hinz of the International Institute for Strategic Studies.
So, in my opinion, it looks like Iran's missile exports are very compartmentalized. So, on the one hand, you're having the missile exports and missile transfers to proxy groups, to non-state allies that very much are part of the Islamic Republic's core ideological and geopolitical project. So, you have missile transfers to Hezbollah in Lebanon, to Shia groups in Iraq, to the Houthis in Yemen. And so far, we basically have observed that these haven't been restrained by anything.
Not even restrained by the UN Security Council sanctions when they were in force?
No. Not even restrained by the UN Security Council sanctions. Not even restrained by other weapons embargoes that also exist in many of these places. We've seen the Iranians transfer very, very sophisticated and also very provocative capabilities to the Houthis, for example. And in the case of the Houthis, we're seeing them openly being paraded around Sana'a. So that includes missiles with ranges of above 1,000 kilometers, long-range precision-guided missiles. So it seems that whenever Iran says missile transfer is part of this core ideological project, then we don't really care about international sanctions and about UN Security Council resolutions.
Can I ask why those UN Security Council sanctions, when they were enforced, why did they not have any impacts on Iran?
So I would say that there's another part of it, and that is Iranian arms exports outside of that core group of Iranian allies. And with these, the international sanctions regime might have a bit more of an impact, because you always have to remember that you need two sides to tango. You have Iran exporting these things, but you also have other countries importing them. And there are a lot of countries around the world that perhaps would be willing to import Iranian technology, but don't want to deal with sanctioned entities, that don't want to get into trouble with the US, Western partners, that don't want to violate international law. And I'm thinking this is where the expiry of the sanctions might have the biggest impact.
So now that the transition day has come, What kind of demand do you think we might see from Iran's partners, from other countries that maybe were concerned about violating UN sanctions in the past, but now wouldn't be?
So if you look at the international arms market, there are a lot of countries you can buy weapons from that aren't Iran. But Iran has a few advantages in the international arms market, and these extend to ballistic missiles and cruise missiles and drones as well. And these are, first, that the Iranian systems are quite cheap. Second, that the Iranian systems can be quite capable. So if you talk about long-range missiles, there are not a lot of countries producing them, and there are even fewer countries willing to sell them. But perhaps the biggest advantage Iran has in the international arms market is their willingness to transfer technology. So imagine you're a country trying to build up your own local arms industry. You really want to produce yourself and keep your money inside the country. A lot of the large companies won't give you the technology to produce yourself. And the Iranians are really willing to do that, and they have lots of experience doing that. They've transferred production technology to their proxies in the region. They transfer production technology to Syria and to Russia, as in the case with the drone factory. And this is something that might be quite interesting for a lot of countries.
Now, the United States has led a group of more than 40 nations that have endorsed what's called the Proliferation Security Initiative in issuing a statement committing themselves to counter-proliferation cooperation against Iran's missile programs. They issued the statement, I think it was on the transition day. That cooperation is supposed to include interdiction efforts. What I'm curious to know is, how actively are the U.S. and its partners actually engaging in actions like interdiction and trying to stop either sales to Iran or exports from Iran of missiles and missile technology?
So far, that really depends on the region. We've seen a lot of interdictions by the U.S. and its allies in the Arabian Gulf. We've seen lots of interdictions of material going to the Yemeni Houthis. That has been very well documented, and there have been huge quantities of arms that have been interdicted, but also production material to build some of these rockets and missile systems in Yemen itself. So this is an area where we've seen a lot of interdictions. I think if you want to expand that effort to other potential Iranian customers, it would be politically difficult, because within Yemen, you can always say, okay, we have certain international obligations that should prevent the transfer of these materials to the Houthis. But if you have a sovereign country that wants to purchase Iranian missiles, and you will have an Iranian shipment to that country, which perhaps might even be a US ally or a country that is not an adversary of the US, I think it would be politically and legally quite difficult to interdict these shipments, which of course does not mean that some nations might not try it, but it's challenging.
So when you're looking forward now in the coming weeks and months, how do you expect Iran's missile-related activities to evolve, given that this big restraint has been lifted off of what they're doing?
So when you look at the month ahead, it has been clear that Iran is interested in the export of ballistic missiles. It has released marketing materials in the English language about some of its missile systems, and we could see some of these systems being exported to countries. I think there is quite a bit of interest in Iranian missile systems around the world. The Iranians have openly said that there is an interest in Iranian ballistic missile systems. But in individual cases, you will also have to see what other restraints there are except international legal considerations. So, for example, would a certain country really jeopardize its military relationship with the US for Iranian ballistic missiles? Some countries might easily do so. Some countries might not have a lot to lose, but for other countries, it might be more of a risk they're not willing to take. So this is an interesting question. And I think the most interesting question is whether we're going to see a ballistic missile sale to Russia going ahead, because there have been reports about Iranian plans to sell ballistic missiles to Russia, but these have not gone forward. And the sanctions under UN Security Council Resolution 2231 were given as one potential reason why these have not gone forward. There are other explanations as well, but I think we're now going to see whether that has been the decisive factor or not.
Well, Fabienne Hinz, research fellow at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, speaking to us from Berlin, Germany. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you so much.
That's all for the program. I'm Michael Lippin. Glad you could join me, and hope you can do the same next week for another Flashpoint Iran.